story Syria's army says it has intercepted most of Israeli missiles fired from the occupied part of Golan Heights over Damascus. The UN chief voices his deep concern about the situation in Myanmar and the military's increasing use of force against people protesting the coup. Also ahead this hour, pro-independence parties in Spain's Catalonia win enough votes to increase their majority in the regional parliament. Welcome to the World News. Syrian air defense systems have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the capital, Damascus. Our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, joined us earlier with more on the attack.
And just a few minutes ago, the Syrian Army Command issued a statement giving some more details, saying at about 1:18 a.m. Local time here in the Syrian capital, the Israeli side carried out an aggression, firing a number of missiles from the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some Syrian army positions, most probably around the capital, Damascus. Syrian air defenses, according to the Syrian army, were directly activated and shot down most of the enemy missiles. Now, this is not the first time that this happens, for sure. Hundreds of attacks, perhaps, since the start of the crisis in Syria. Israel has been attacking the Syrian army with the aim to undermine the capabilities of the Syrian army, which is fighting terrorists on the ground.
February 14 marks 10 years since a popular uprising began in Bahrain against the ruling Al Khalifa regime. Calls for change and equality have continued since then, despite a crackdown against dissent. Earlier, we discussed that issue in our news review program.
Ten years have passed since an uprising roared into life in Bahrain against an undemocratic regime. People in the Persian Gulf Kingdom still hold rallies, though sporadic, to make their voices heard and to condemn the ruling Al Khalifa's crackdown on their popular movement. Bahraini people seem adamant in their pursuit of reform on the anniversary of the 2011 revolution. We have a report on that.
February 14, 2011 was the beginning of an uprising in Bahrain that brought tens of thousands of people to the streets across the tiny island to call for reform. But the peaceful movement soon turned bloody when the Al Khalifa dynasty began to quell demonstrations with an iron fist. Backed by forces deployed from Saudi Arabia in the early months of the uprising and mercenaries from other countries, the Bahraini regime launched a brutal clampdown. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries, but those outcries failed to stop a kingdom that hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet.
The United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region, and so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power. So that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there.
Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party, Al-Wafaq, in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. It also revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people, including prominent cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. From the Iranian city of Qom, the 84-year-old spiritual leader marked the uprising anniversary via televised address.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands. And they have great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take.
He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al Khalifa regime. He noted that the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country. On the eve of the uprising anniversary, Bahrainis staged nationwide rallies, including in the capital Manama, and renewed their call for the downfall of King Hamad and his monarchy. The demonstrators also demanded that all political prisoners be freed. 10 years after the first wave of demonstrations rocked Bahrain, people are still hoping that their resistance would bring about democratic reforms, progress on human rights, as well as accountability for past and present abuses.
Okay, with that report, let's now invite one of our guests to see what she thinks about all of this. Fatima Yazbek, human rights activist, is joining us out of Melbourne. Good to have you with us, lady. So you just heard the report and the Bahraini people out there, and this is while 10 years passed since the uprising that they had in their country. Still, they are there, and they are trying to cry out and talk about their voices of dissent. So what is this indicative of?
I want to congratulate the Bahraini people on their courage to keep demanding their rightful demands for 10 years, to keep speaking out and to keep calling out the government and asking to have their legal rights. The continuous uprising or the continuous demonstrations for 10 years now today indicates how the will of the Bahraini people and indicates how much the government or Al Khalifa are oppressors and how much they want to control the country. Through these 10 years, we've seen so much violations, we've seen so much oppression, but the people kept on demonstrating, kept on protesting, and kept on demanding their rights. And as I said, that shows us how much they are willing to change, and how much they were oppressed, and how much they are sick of that oppression now that they need to change the current situation.
Okay. Now, from Beirut, we are also joined by another guest. We have Ghena Rabai, researcher with the Bahrain Forum for Human Rights. Good to have you with us, Ghena. So how do you look at this? Tell us what the Bahraini people want, what their demands are, and the way that the Al Khalifa regime has treated them.
After 10 years since the beginning of the uprising in Bahrain, and with the demonstrations and different forms of protest still going on, in over 80 regions in Bahrain, whether cities, towns, villages, since they cannot make one mass protest in Al Manama anymore after the oppression in 2011, in spite of the authorities' suppressions on those protests, I would say a suitable title for this uprising would be Peaceful Demands, stressing on the word peaceful. For 10 years, the Bahraini people never backed up from demanding their rights, but always maintained peacefulness in their methods. On the other hand, you asked me how the authorities react. On the other hand, what were the reactions of the authorities towards those peaceful protests? We can see that the authorities always reacted with oppression and violations of basic rights. There have been more than 15,000 prisoners of conscience, among whom there were more than 1,500 minors and more than 200 women along the 10 years of the uprising.
Okay. Thank you very much for your contribution and comments. We had Ghena Rabai, researcher with Bahrain Forum for Human Rights, who joined us from Beirut. And also Fatima Yazbek, human rights activist out of Melbourne. And that's it for this edition of the News Review. Thank you.
Welcome back. The UN Secretary General has called on Myanmar's military to immediately allow the World Body Special Envoy into the country to assess the situation. A UN statement said Antonio Guterres has made the request during a contact with the military. The statement said the Secretary General is deeply concerned about the conditions in Myanmar. Guterres urged the military and the police to respect the citizens' right to peaceful gatherings and not to persecute them, describing as unacceptable reports of continued violence by security agencies. The statements came after security forces fired at demonstrators and arrested journalists in the country's north on Sunday. Protests are going on in Myanmar against the recent military coup that toppled the country's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Protesters are also demanding detainees, including Suu Kyi, be released. Now, pro-independence parties in Spain's Catalonia have won the largest number of seats in the regional parliament, expanding their majority. With over 90% of the votes counted, three pro-independence parties secured a total of 74 seats in the 135-seat assembly. That is up from 70 seats won in the last election in December of 2017. However, the Specialist, or I should say the Socialist Party, that leads Spain's central government got 33 seats, which are more than any other single party. For the first time, the far-right Vox Party entered the autonomous region's parliament, winning 11 seats. The turnout was low due to the pandemic at 53%, this despite voters with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 symptoms being able to cast their ballots in a special time slot. Political commentator Layo Shajdi says Catalonia's pro-independence parties are deeply divided and it is not certain if they could put in place a functioning grand coalition.
And even though the pro-independence parties got in a total of collectively 74 seats, but we also have to pay attention to the fact that they are, I believe, deeply divided. I mean, there is only one thing that would have in common, independence. But for instance, you have Esquerra Republicana Catalana, they are communists, and they got 33 seats. Then you have Junts per Catalunya, I believe, it's 32 seats. They are like, I would say, nationalists. They are not communists, they are not far left or left. It will be like nationalist, Republican, pro-independence Catalonians. And then you have, I believe, nine seats for the CUP, Candidatura de Unidad Popular, Candidacy for Popular Unity. Those are hardcore communists. I mean, I would say they are, if not Stalinists, they are very close to or pro-Castro, pro-Cuba, communist dictatorship kind of regime they would like to have. So in case, I mean, would it be possible to make a grand coalition among those? And even if they do, they wouldn't represent the entire, I mean, the rest, the 47% of Catalonians or residents of Catalonia that did not vote.
A new report indicates French hospitals will move into crisis mode from Thursday over fears of a possible surge in coronavirus cases due to highly contagious variants. A French health ministry's memo seen by a local newspaper says regional health agencies and hospitals have been asked to mobilize all medical staff resources and to increase the number of hospital beds available. The plan also involves delaying non-urgent surgeries. France has resisted a new lockdown in contrast with some of its neighbors hoping a curfew in place since December will contain the pandemic. France trails behind several other European countries in rolling out vaccinations. Meanwhile, the country reported over 16,000 new COVID-19 cases on Sunday. The country's total cases stand at over 3.4 million. The government also reported 167 new COVID-19 deaths in hospitals, taking the total to around 82,000. Kristen Hond says the French government hesitates to impose new lockdown over economic concerns and fear of public backlash.
Despite the curfew, which is going on all over the territory, going in after 6 p.m., the deaths and new contaminations do not go down. I mean, there are still more than, in an average, more than 300 deaths every day, and a total of 80,000 diseases in total. So the French government is very hesitating to impose a new lockdown, because a lockdown for economic reasons is very nefast, and also the population would not accept it. Now there is a new problem that the South African variant has been detected in the northeast in France, and scientists cannot explain how it comes there. This variant is very contagious. They fear that this will increase the number of contaminations and the number of patients who will arrive in hospitals. That's why the situation in hospitals is rather critical. And furthermore, the vaccination campaign is much, much slower than in other European countries. I mean, only 3 million of persons have been vaccinated. Just one comparison, in the UK, about 12 million persons have been vaccinated.
The United States of former President Donald Trump has been found not guilty in his second impeachment trial. Has the post-Trump era finally begun after so much acrimony and fighting? That is just one of the many unanswered questions in a rather traumatized and divided nation. Ramin Mazoheri reports from Chicago.
Ex-President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his second impeachment trial, finally closing the curtain on the nation's bitterly disputed election last November. Trump was accused of incitement to insurrection after a violent protest stormed Capitol Hill as Congress was certifying the Electoral College's selection of Joe Biden. Polls still show that around 40% of voters think that Biden's victory was illegitimate. Public opinion was almost evenly split regarding Trump's responsibility in the Capitol Hill protests and along party lines. The Senate vote's outcome was never in doubt, as a two-thirds supermajority was needed for conviction. The trial was surprisingly rushed to completion.
Trump's big sin, from the point of view of the American ruling class, is that he brought the pitchforks to the castle. And that's what the ruling class is, and the entire apparatus of status quo politics in the United States is punishing Donald Trump for, and wants to make sure never happens again.
Democrats now have to contend with an exonerated Trump who can run for the presidency in 2024. Conservatives may be permanently divided into two factions, and polls show that a third party started by Trump would be even more popular than the Republican Party. The final fate of the controversial Trump seemed to overshadow what sparked the violent protest in the first place, yet the question remains: how can massive and violent disputes over electoral integrity be prevented?
A, have an electoral system that people have confidence in and can have confidence in, which we don't have. But even more, hey, we're giving you medical care. You have medical care. Your rent is paid. You have a job. You have an income. You know, you don't have to worry about student debt. How many of those people are going to come to fight you over that?
Other questions remain, which are even more difficult to answer. Can a Trump-obsessed nation actually move on? Will Washington now focus on fixing the socioeconomic catastrophes caused by the coronavirus and lockdowns? How can this deeply divided nation heal? And when? And maybe, do they even want to? Given Trump's acquittal, many wonder if the impeachment trial ultimately did more harm than good. The Trump presidential era may be definitively over, finally, but the transition to get there was anything but peaceful. Ramin Mazaheri, Chicago.
Elsewhere, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, calling on President Jovenel Moïse to step down. Clashes erupted between the demonstrators and police. The rallies were held after a judge proposed by the opposition called on the people to fight against what he called a dictatorship. The opposition says Moïse's term ended last week. The president, however, says he was sworn in for a five-year term, which ends in February of next year. The opposition stands accused of trying to kill the president and stage a coup against his government. Institutions that can break the stalemate over the president's term lack authorization, including the Haitian parliament, which, mind you, only exists on paper.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
The Biden administration sparked a sense of hope around the world that the war on Yemen could finally be over. For those on the ground, though, the bombs keep falling. Food is scarce and hope is in the short supply, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "This is Yemen after Biden declared an end to American support for the war." Stay tuned for the details, please. Seated next to his 13-year-old daughter, Hakima's bed in Thawra Hospital, Al-Hanishi watches a breaking news report on a small TV screen announcing that the President of the United States has announced an end to U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on his country. But Al-Hanishi took the news with skepticism. The Biden said he will end support to Mohammed bin Salman, but will help Saudi Arabia to defend herself. "Come on," said Al-Hanishi, who asked that only his first initial and tribal surname be used for fear of reprisal. Al-Hanishi now lives in Dubi Village in Yemen's Nim district, about 25 miles east of Sana'a, after living for years as an internally displaced person in the country's capital. He remembers the moment that the war on his country was first announced from a podium in Washington, D.C., by Adel Al Jubeir, the former Saudi ambassador to the United States, and he believes just as it began in Washington, the war can only end from there. Despite the recent talk of the U.S. ending support for the war, the Saudi-led coalition has only intensified military maneuvers in Yemen in recent weeks. Saudi regime warplanes are seen regularly above highly populated urban areas in the north of the country, dropping hundreds of tons of weapons, most supplied by the United States regime. In the oil-rich Mareb province, Saudi warplanes are trying to prevent local militant groups and militias once allied with the Saudi-led coalition. Since February 3rd, when the Biden administration announced it would end support for offensive Saudi regime action against Yemen, the Saudi-led coalition has also doubled down on its blockade of the country, preventing oil ships and even materials used to dispose of unexploded ordnance, including cluster bombs, from entering the country. In Sa'deh, Hajjeh, and the oil-rich Ma'reb province, more than 150 airstrikes using the U.S.-made bombs, including MK-81, 82, 83, 84, cluster bombs, have been carried out according to Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center, YEMAC, an organization backed by the United Nations. These attacks could not happen without a green light from the United States regime. And all the talk about peace and an end to support for Riyadh are little more than talk for the sake of diplomatic consumption. Last week, Hakima Al-Hanishi lost her left hand to an unexploded ordnance. She was playing with her younger brother when they came upon an unusual-looking object they thought looked like a toy. But it was not a toy. It was an unexploded cluster munition dropped by a Saudi jet. Ali Safra, the Director General of the Yemen Executive Mine Action Center, YEMAC, said that the civilian casualties from unexploded ordnances far exceed 1,000. Most are women and children from agricultural and grazing areas. Safra says that the Saudi-led coalition has dropped 3,000 179 cluster bombs on Yemen, including the BLU-616397AB, the M-71, the BLO-108, and BLO-77. All U.S.-made cluster bombs. Safra says that European and Latin American cluster bombs, such as the British BMLT-12, the French ZP-39, and Brazilian SA-2, have also been used. Altogether, YEMAC has identified at least 13 different types of cluster bombs, all dropped by warplanes, most often supplied by the United States regime, and often on hospitals, schools, markets, mosques, farms, factories, bridges, and power and water treatment plants. Over there, they're talking about peace. But here, we hear nothing but the roar of American-made warplanes over our heads and the sounds of explosions from their bombs, one father told Min Press News. His 13-year-old son, Rad, and two children, 13-year-old Ragat Saleh Al-Shaul and 10-year-old Najwa Ali Matari, are being treated for serious injuries at Al-Thawra Hospital after they were struck by cluster bomb as they were grazing their sheep in Al-Ghafra in nearby Sana'a province. We need an end to the airstrikes and a lifting of the blockade, not deceptive statements by the United States regime, Rad's father added angrily. Biden's announcement to end support to Saudi Arabia did little to alleviate Yemeni's concerns. It lacked clarity or specificity as to what policies would be introduced to effect that change. It did not mention the blockade on Yemen, and it reiterated Washington's support for Saudi Arabia's right to defend itself. That statement left many Yemenis feeling that Biden was expressing sympathy towards Saudi Arabia regime and ignoring the plight of Yemenis, who have been much harder hit by the war. Doctors struggling to keep 13-year-old Hakima alive say she must travel abroad for treatment as Al-Thawra Hospital, like most in Yemen, is suffering from a shortage of medical equipment, medicine, and lack of fuel to run generators. I cannot evacuate her. The airport is closed. What am I supposed to do? Hakima's father asked Main Press. The ongoing blockade on Sana'a's international airport, imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and supported by the United States regime, has caused the deaths of more than 80,000 medical patients. More than 450,000 patients still need to travel abroad to receive treatment, according to the Director General of the Sana'a International Airport, Khaled Al-Shaif, as well as a number of civil society organizations that participated in a joint press conference recently. According to the Yemeni Ministry of Health, over 3,000 patients registered with the ministry suffer from cardiac abnormalities and urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Over 12,000 patients with kidney failure need urgent transplants, and more than 65 cases of cancer risk death if they are unable to get treatment outside of Yemen. He confirmed that the airport is completely safe and in complete technical readiness to receive flights, indicating that the only obstacle to reopening the airport and lifting the ban is the intransigence of the coalition countries and the complicity of the United Nations. The The United States regime has not only been complicit in supporting Saudi attacks, which have killed more than a quarter of a million people, destroyed infrastructure, and left Yemen one of the most heavily contaminated countries in the world. It has directly assisted in the enforcement of a blockade that has caused Yemen's complete economic collapse. Yemenis are now left with the stark reality that Biden's statements have changed little on the ground. People are still suffering from cholera, malnutrition, and starvation, from horrific atrocities and indiscriminate bombing and shelling, from the destruction of infrastructure and the economy. Hundreds of thousands have perished, millions are displaced, and tens of millions have been left impoverished. The long-term effects of malnutrition and trauma on an entire generation of young Yemenis ensure the cost of this war will continue for decades to come. Just as the war was announced from Washington, the only likely end to the war will be announced from Washington.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us start a day by contemplating on a brilliant piece of advice from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, the 15th fallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I admonish you regarding five things. If you're wronged, do not commit wrongdoing to others. If you are betrayed, do not betray anyone. If you are called a liar, do not be furious. If you are praised, do not be jubilant. If you are criticized, do not fret but think of what is said in criticism. If you find in yourself what is criticized about you, then you are falling down in the eyes of God. When you are furious about the truth, it is much greater calamity. Then you're falling down in the eyes of people. And if you are opposite of what is said in criticism about you, then it is a merit you acquired without having to tire yourself in obtaining it.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and it's about his life and times and the impact this man made on not only the Muslim world, but the entire globe as a whole. Once again, I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And I'd like to bring in Dr. Mahdi Turabi, my good friend, on this subject. And I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much again. Dr. Mahdi Turabi, we spoke at length about, the impact that Imam Khomeini made, as you said, on a pretty materialistic, secular world in which religion was marginalized, and how Imam, by living Islam, made an enormous impact on reviving and putting religion back on the world map. But now we want to move on a bit more, because I remember, as you will as well, that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, the first thing I remember about him was his call for unity. And he would say that it is perfectly permissible to go to Sunni mosques and pray behind a Sunni prayer imam, and so on and so forth, so that we could foster fraternity, unity, in the spirit that our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, used to do right at the beginning and the outset of Islam, to bring brotherhood and genuine friendship amongst each other, so that with this unity, we would become powerful in this world. Your take on that, Dr. Mahdi Turabi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's exactly as you said it, which is that, the only ones that benefit from, us fighting, Sunni Shia fighting, are the enemies of Islam.
Exactly.
So it's
exactly.
As simple as that.
It's as simple
there's
as
really
that.
Not, yeah. It's not really that complicated.
No, it's not.
The things that we have differences on, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But, the majority of things we don't have differences on.
And the other thing was that we were asked...
You focus on that,
yes.
The other things,
yeah.
And you do it in a peaceful way, and you do it
sure.
as you would with your brother, in the sense that you love each other, and you take care of each other, and you help each other.
Yes.
And the difference is you try to work out with each other.
Well,
the other thing was,
Dr. Mahdi, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the other thing is that, as far as what I remember, the message was that there was no need for a Shia to be a Sunni or a Sunni to be a Shia. The main thing was that we, respect each other's beliefs, respect each other's points of view, but the main thing is that we are united in terms of our purpose in living Islam, creating this Islamic civilization, and, presenting an alternative to the rest of the world that is sinking in social ills and corruption and all kinds of deviance, which, Islam purifies us from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And look at our history. I mean,
yeah.
the reason that, they were able to come and take over the Muslim world is because we were divided. I mean, it's simple.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult.
No, it's not. It's not
okay.
Rocket science, as they say.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
Okay? When we were divided, they were united, they took over.
Exactly.
Wassalam.
Okay. Wassalam, yes, exactly.
Okay.
I could say that even now. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
And they're still doing it.
Yeah,
and the reason they like having Al Saud be the guardians of Mecca and Medina is because, and the Takfiri, is because that's going to lead,
to more division.
That helps them keep control of the Muslim world.
Exactly.
And if you get rid of Al Saud and the Takfiri, that's it.
Absolutely.
How much better would that be for the Muslims, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because this is the main source of contention at the moment, the main root cause of...
And remember, the Takfiris are not Sunni.
No, they're not. No, no.
The Takfiris are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No,
they're
no.
Takfiris.
They're enemies. They're actually the...
They're the enemies.
They're the hypocrites
the ones,
that the Quran speaks
the ones,
about.
they're the ones that are doing the bidding of the Zionists in America.
Exactly, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay, why are you so, you know, when are you going to get it?
Absolutely.
I almost said it. why are you going to get it?
Because, I mean, it's in the words of Netanyahu himself. He says Saudi is the last line of defense for this illegitimate state of Israel.
I'm just saying, you know, to all Muslims, Sunni, Shia, young, old, you know, brothers and sisters.
Sure.
You know, it's so clear to everyone now what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, whatever, 30 years ago, whatever.
Mm.
Okay? Isn't it clear now who's with who gets money from who is, you know, giving money to cannibals and organ eaters and who is...
Yes, yes. Yes, Vladimir Putin, who said, yes, I'm not going to support organ eaters. I don't want my kidney to be cooked by a takfiri.
You know,
yeah.
It's time to step up. And I'm
exactly.
talking, you know, mainly the Sunni brothers and sisters. You see the realities. Why are you still stuck? Why are you still worried about? What are you still, you know, why are you still confused?
Mm.
Why are you confused? Look at what happened to Ikhwan.
Yes.
They trusted. They went with the Saudis. They went with the Americans. They got burned. This is mainly, you know, addressed to the Sunni brothers.
Yes, absolutely.
Look at what has happened in the last year.
Yes. Particularly in Egypt, yes.
Egypt, in Turkey, and all those places where the so-called, you know...
Brotherhood.
The mainstream, moderate, the proper, you know, Islamic movements, the minute they aligned themselves with the Saudis and with the Israelis and the Americans, they got burnt.
They got burnt,
They got stabbed in the back.
Exactly. And Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was warning against this kind of thing, wasn't he? He was telling them...
Why are you still having such problems with Shias?
Exactly.
What's your problem?
Yeah.
Who's been talking about unity since, you know, 40 years?
Yeah, exactly.
Who's been supporting, you know, Sunni resistance movements like Hamas?
Like Hamas in Palestine, yes, absolutely.
Right? Who is the one that's, you know, supporting, you know, getting support from Israel?
Exactly.
And getting support from America and getting support from the Saudis. The Saudis, you know, Morsi comes to power, Saudis give him a couple billion in order to buy him off.
Yes.
The minute he's overthrown, the first person congratulating, you know, the military in Egypt is Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that
what
you want to be your leader?
General Sisi got a pat in the back there. Yes, absolutely.
You want Al-Assad to be your leaders? Is that the kind of leaders you want? Forget about Sunni Shia.
Yeah.
Is that who you want to be your leader? Or do you want somebody who's been talking about unity, who's been doing, who's been acting it, who's been...
Living it,
who's been acting, living on it.
Living on it.
For the last 34 years.
Exactly.
Who was able to become independent from their, you know, previous imperial master, who's, you know, everybody's educated, everybody's participating in the elections, everybody's, you know, has a future. And yes, there are difficulties, of course, there's sanctions, there's things that all so-called developing countries are going through, but where would you rather be today?
Yes.
Where is
That's
the
a very good question. Very
where
good
is the
question.
Future today?
Yes.
Right?
Quite.
So now you have a generation of youth in the Muslim world who are either faced with becoming takfiris or, you know, becoming westernized, you know, servants of America and Israel. That's it. These are the two options they're giving you.
My God, they're both ugly. Not a choice I'd like to make.
This is the way. And, you know, either way, you're abandoning your religion.
Of course you are.
Right?
Of course you are.
Either way, you're going against the precepts of your religion.
Yeah, exactly.
Against the Quran, against the Sunnah.
Yes, sir.
If you become the servants of non-Muslims, you're going against it. If you become takfiri and, you know, organ-eating cannibals,
yep.
you know,
yep.
you're going against your religion. So
sure.
they're basically saying to you, you got to give up your religion. So why do you have a problem with Imam now still?
Exactly. Exactly. It's a very good question.
Didn't Imam show a successful way of being able to maintain your religion?
Sure.
And
the other thing I wanted to raise, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, was...
And your maintain your servitude to God and to maintain your allegiance to the Prophet, peace be upon him, without having to become a servant, without having to become a crazy...
A slave.
You know, lunatic.
Yeah, a lunatic, a slave and a lunatic.
Organ eater.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that good? Isn't
yes.
that a way to go? Isn't that maybe an option you should start considering?
Well, I must admit and I must confess, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, you know, he began the whole process of Unity Week. You know, he came up with this Unity Week, this conference by which we could all come together on the birthday of the Holy Prophet. Doesn't matter about the differences of what we understand historically.
I mean,
that was the genius of the whole thing.
Instead of turning it into a point of contention.
Yeah.
He said, "Okay, one riwayat, one hadith is this day; the other one is the other one. So yeah. we'll have the whole week.
We'll have the whole week to celebrate the Holy Prophet.
We'll
birthday.
Celebrate the whole week. You know,
why not?
It's a week apart or whatever. A couple days apart.
We get 2 weeks for Christmas, don't we?
Right. So yeah. Then you have what's day? You know, which is the Friday of Ramadan.
That's right.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, excuse me. Are the Palestinians Shia? Is that the reason why we support?
No. I don't think they are, as far as I remember."
I mean, who supported the Palestinians more than the Imam and his movement? And
that's
the
right.
Which country? Who's paid more for this stance in the international era than Iran?
Absolutely.
So why are you still stuck with this? Why are you still following people like Ali Saud and these, you know, ignorant people who claim to follow Islam, but they're just servants of the non-Muslims? When are you going to wake up? When are you going to finally get it? Look at what happened to Morsi. Where is Morsi today? The first democratically civilian elected president of Egypt.
That's right.
Just think about that.
Yeah.
Why? Because instead of going and becoming close with those people who were supporting you for 40 years, when everybody else, when you remember at the beginning in the 80s, who was supporting Ikhwan in Egypt when they were all being sent to prison and being executed?
It was Iran.
Right.
It was the Islamic Revolution.
Right. And so what happens? So instead of going and, you know, sticking with the one that's proven itself to be the real deal.
The real deal, McCoy. That's right, yes.
The real McCoy.
The real McCoy, the voice
you
of
go,
the voiceless.
You go, you know, trying to satisfy the Saudis and, you know, calling Shias Najis and, you know, whatever.
Or whatever, yes.
That's
right.
You know, talking about the way they did about Hezbollah in Syria and whatever and all that stuff. And what's the result?
Well, there we are. I think that
you know, your own defense minister does a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you got the Europeans and the American envoys coming and telling you, well, you know, just accept reality. Let's move on.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I think you know, the more we progress in history, the longer we are around and we see the things as they are happening, the more we realize that from the very, very beginning, Imam had gotten it right all the way.
All the way, he was. I mean, this is the miracle, isn't it? I mean, this is the genius of it all that just shows the, you know, some kind of divine quality that of the Imam that he.
Well, if you're connected, you're connected,
yeah.
and it's not anything mysterious.
No,
you have to be careful the way you said it. People might think there's some sort of we're trying to. There's nothing mysterious about it. This is the normal way that Allah works.
This is the normal way that Allah
works.
You're quite right, sir. I stand corrected.
Yes. Yes. You have to be careful the way you talk about these things because this is exactly the things they use against us.
Yes.
When you read the Quran, this is a normal cause and effect.
Normal cause and effect,
trust me, I will take care of you.
Quite.
This is not a miracle. It's a normal way that Allah does things.
Yes.
He says, I'm your wali. What does that mean? Not Tawhut, not, you know, others are your wali. When you trust in Allah the way Imam did, you will be successful.
You will be successful, absolutely.
More than that, we even have the ayat in the Quran, which all the Mufassirin, Sunni and Shia, say that refer to Imam Ali alayhi salam. And they talk about being the ones that are successful and being the ones that are the party of God and
being
the ones that will be, you know, the ones that are in this world, successful in this world and in the next.
That's right.
So why don't you follow the Quran? Forget about the hadith right now. We're not talking about hadith.
No, we're talking about Quran, yes.
I'm sorry, because you are Mr. Hadith, so I apologize.
No, the hadith is always secondary. It's a secondary source. The primary source is the Quran.
Imam is following Imam when he talked about what he did in terms of how we should live our Islam and how we should be active politically.
Yes.
He was talking Quran.
He was talking Quran. Very nice. That's very beautiful.
So why don't you follow Quran?
Why don't you follow when you're following... Yes, because you said the Quran was kafi, wasn't it? It said that the Quran was enough. And the Imam proved that the Quran is enough if you follow it.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that when you follow Imam Khomeini, you're following
You're following the Quran, absolutely.
You're not. It's not about Sunni Shia.
No, it's not.
Why was Imam successful? Why was the Islamic Republic successful?
Yes.
Why is the Islamic Republic successful? Mm. Why do we have great leaders like Rahbat, like the supreme leader that we have?
Yes.
And he's a great leader. I mean, look at him. I mean, I'm talking about just, you know, as a Muslim, looking at somebody as a religious scholar, as a political leader.
Yes.
Who is guiding us.
Yes.
Isn't it great? You know, thank God we have somebody like him.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, and this is not about, you know, hero worship. This is about thanking God for, you know, putting the appropriate leaders for us.
Exactly.
Before there was Imam.
Yes.
And, you know, and the reason these people are good leaders is because they follow Islam. They follow the Quran. They follow the school of Ahlul Bayt, the Islam that is taught by Ahlul Bayt. And God says that if you do this, you will be successful.
You'll get good governance.
You won't be oppressed. You won't be, you know, 1 minute the president, the next minute in jail.
In jail, yes. I mean, this is what we can say about the beautiful scene that we saw just very recently with Dr. Rouhani's inauguration as president, that how smoothly things were transferred.
And it
came with a kiss from the supreme leader. You don't get kissed often as a president,
again,
do you?
Again, let's make it real for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
In the speech at that time, what was the main point that the supreme leader talked about?
Sure.
He said, it is a great blessing that the transfer of government in our country is done peacefully.
It's done peacefully, absolutely. Absolutely.
He said, this is one of the greatest blessings.
This is a great thing, absolutely.
And then he said, look at Egypt. Look at all
Egypt.
The other countries.
Yes, he did. He did compare it. Of course he compared it.
So look at us. Mm. We followed Imam. Imam was following the Quran and the school of Ahlul Bayt, which is Faghalain.
Yes.
Quran and Ahlul Bayt, which is back goes back to what the Prophet said.
Yes.
The Prophet, peace be upon him, said, I will leave you two weighty matters. I will leave with you two weighty things.
Sure.
The Quran and my Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And if you follow them, you will be successful. So why don't you follow them?
No, that's a very good question. It's a very good question
after,
to our audience.
Why are you going after people and things that have no value to you?
No.
Who will lead you to Zulamat.
Yes, and will lead you astray.
They will lead you to darkness.
Darkness.
Look at what happened to Morsi. Make it a lesson for yourself.
Mm.
Look at these poor guys in Turkey, in Ankara.
Absolutely.
They don't know what to do now.
There's the same problem in Tunisia. I mean, this is widespread, you know. I mean, Libya is in absolute chaos. I mean, what can you say?
You know, so this is the thing.
Mm.
When Imam came, there were, you know, the humanity, and especially the Muslims, were thirsting and were completely in need of guidance.
Yes.
The guidance, that's the real guidance. If you're going to have, to go back to our example that we used in the previous program.
Yes.
If you have the computer and then you put the wrong
software
in
it,
it's not going to work.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It'll never
you might even have it working for a while, but then there's so many bugs in it and there's so many problems with it that eventually it crashes.
It crashes. Very good.
Good. Are we now talking, you know?
I think so. It's the same language.
You get it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's a very good paradigm. It's a very good model to express
you
the
know,
idea.
It might work for a while. It's like, you know, it's okay. Should we go further on this? It's like Apple versus Windows. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Chalk and cheese.
You know, you're going to have certain operating systems. They might work for a while, but they've got so many bugs and problems in them, they're going to crash after a while.
Well, they're going to crash, exactly.
Some of them don't even work to begin with. Mm. Others, they work for a while and they crash.
Yes.
What you want is you want the one that doesn't have the bugs in it.
That's right. It's got the antivirus in it, you know. It's.
It doesn't even need the antivirus.
Virus.
Beyond all this stuff.
Very good point, yes. It doesn't even need the antivirus. You're absolutely right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, when you're a Muslim and you have a person like Imam coming and living at approximately the same time you did, right? You have no excuse on the Day of Judgment then.
No.
You can't say to Allah, I didn't know. He said, why? You didn't know? Well, there was a mom. He was on every channel on TV.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Right?
I mean, I watched him on News at 10, you know, on ITN in the UK, so I don't have much of an excuse either,
right.
You know?
You know, 50,000 websites, you know, hundreds of books, you know.
True.
What's your excuse on the Day of Judgment? I didn't know. Of course you knew.
Of course you knew.
you not only knew because of the Quran and the Rivayat that were, you know, available to you, but more than that, it's you had somebody who, you know, is an Islamic scholar.
Yes.
Who was a practicing, you know, Muslim, who was a political leader telling you.
Yes.
So alhamdulillah, those of us who were, you know, fortunate enough to have been living in his time, you know, alhamdulillah, because he really taught us real Islam.
Sure.
Who knows where we would, who knows where we would be without him?
Oh my goodness! I think the tyranny of the Shah would still be continuing to this day.
You know what's even worse than that? We would be caricatures of Muslims.
You would be. That's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely
and you too,
true.
By the way.
I know. I wouldn't be here for a start. I mean, where would Scottish independence be? You know, I don't think anything would have happened.
Well, I'm trying to simply say that even if you were Muslim,
yeah,
which is inshallah we would all be,
yeah,
but
inshallah,
you would we would be very, you know, it would be a caricature. It would be a very kind
yeah.
Of,
I mean,
know,
I don't know. Maybe I would have been in another
faith. A weak version of it. You know,
yes,
we have this thing. I mean, Imam comes and tells us, look, if you want to do Islam, it's all of it. It's holistic.
It's holistic
package. It's a full program.
Full program. Yep.
It's, you know, it's your night prayers and it's, you know, your political activity during the day. This
sure
is also what Supreme Leader talked about. We talked about that in the previous program.
That's right.
That, you know, he would pray at night and beg for mercy from Allah and you know, have that kind of
faith and trust in
God,
Allah,
which is what you want.
Yes.
That, you know, you have nothing and you have to get everything from Allah.
Get everything from Allah, yes, absolutely.
And during
right
the day, you would, you know, come out like a, you know, lion and be a champion of the Muslims and be the one that
and the champion
the
oppressed. Yes, absolutely.
Of all the oppressed,
absolutely.
So this is what Islam is. It's not just, you know, praying and fasting. It's more than that. It's good. You pray, you fast. That's the basis of it.
That's the basis of it. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So again, nobody should misunderstand what we're saying. We're not saying you shouldn't.
No, no, we're not saying that. No, this is the basis of it.
We're saying that's the minimum.
That's the minimum, yeah.
You sure know?
That's the minimum, absolutely.
And I'm not claiming that I'm any better than anyone or that I do more than all that.
No.
Maybe, you know, I'm doing the minimum as well. But
yes,
that's the minimum. Don't think that that's the maximum. That's not the maximum. That's just the beginning.
That's just the beginning, yes.
The maximum or close to the maximum is what you see with a person like Imam.
Imam
the real Khomeini maximum is what you see
Rahmatullahi
with the Prophet,
absolutely,
him,
may God bless
and
him.
And with the Imam,
sure.
Right? So
because it's all
more
about us trying to become to achieve some kind of perfection and salvation in this world. And Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, gave us a living example of what that could be in this century,
right,
and beyond.
You're right, and it's not just this kind of, you know, parochial, you know. I mean, it really. I think about it, and it really upsets me to think about that they would turn Islam into this kind of very, you know, unimportant thing of like, oh, just, you know, the way you clean yourself and the way you pray and like, that's it. Allah, all the 125,000 prophets because of that, you know.
My God.
All the wars, all the struggles, you know, all the struggles of the Prophet, peace be upon him, all the struggles of the Imams, you know, Shahadat, you know, Karbala, Ashura, because of that.
No, it's ridiculous.
Is that it? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
It's a ridiculous notion that this would be Islam. It's a ridiculous notion that Islam wouldn't be political. It's a ridiculous notion.
Absolutely.
It's not even worth discussing.
No.
You know, this is the problem
it's a very serious point. You know, this is something that
our
listeners
problem
must
for 34
take.
34 years, we're trying to explain to the Muslims themselves that no, really, Islam is political. It's not even worth discussing. It's not even. Of course, it's political.
It should be something second nature to you.
Of course, it's political.
Yeah.
Of course, it has to do with society. Of course, it has to do with helping the poor. Of course, it has to do with helping the oppressed.
Yeah. And establishing an Islamic civilization, a system,
exactly,
a system by which we live
and
die.
And establishing Islamic governments is just the first step for that.
Yes.
The next step is, and the ultimate goal is Islamic civilization.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, and we're not the ones that are imperialist and wanting to impose it on all of humanity, because that's what's going to happen when we have Zuhur.
Yes.
In terms of, that's not our job. Our job is not to impose things on anyone.
No.
Okay?
No.
I don't even know what's going to happen after Zuhur, but that's not even my concern right now.
No,
because
no.
Zuhur is going to happen, and you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
That's that. But at this moment in time, we're concentrating, as you say, on getting the foundations in place.
At this moment in time, our goal is to build a strong, powerful, you enlightened, conscious